Again, in Taiwanese, the word is seen. And so there's qi, sam, seen. All these things are kind of like shook. In Shanghainese, it's sung. And these are all based on rather natural changes that happened over time, so that what began certainly as one Chinese language, certainly archaic Chinese, if not precisely Middle Chinese, has become all of these different things over time. And that's just a natural process. And as these languages go, the tones change too. And so the tone is different on the various reflexes of what once was shook, because tones tend to get bounced around. So another thing that makes it hard for these speakers of these dialects to understand one another is that even when the words happen to have stayed rather the same, often the tone will be different. And as we've seen, tone can make the difference between your mother and a horse. And so you have to be very careful. So it's likely that there was one first language. And then it's important to remember that even that language would have immediately started changing. And so often it's thought, well, where might that first language still be spoken? But have to remember that they've been around a long, long time. And so it's not as if somehow they have some sort of council where they sit and prevent sounds from changing or something like that. So the way things are looking is that probably the closest thing to the first language spoken, if there is a descendant of it, it's probably the click languages, for reasons that we'll see. They may trace back to the very first thing, but they're nothing like they used to be because the change had to keep happening. Then, on the other hand, we know that in fact, there have been spreadings from that first group. And as soon as people started splitting off and going to other places, you started having these variations on a theme. And so this means that you got a new language. So today's 6,000 languages are the product of that process. So to pull the camera back, as I often say, there would have been this Proto-Indo-European ancestor. And we can imagine that at one point that was spoken by a pretty small group of people, now lost to us. And then, over time, that language, when it was spread to different places, ended up spreading into a bunch of what we call sister languages. And those would have been, say, Latin, ancient Greek, Sanskrit, languages that are no longer spoken, at least in any real way. Then each of them split off its own bunch of little sisters, and then you have languages like the Romance languages or Germanic languages like English. You coat the whole globe with that process as it happens over a very long period of time. So that's the point that we're at now, and in the next lecture, we will take a look at some things going on in one particular language, ours.
Lecture 7, How Language Changes, Modern English.
Before we move on in the series to looking at Indo-European, I wanted to take one more look at these change processes in a local way. And I think that it's plain to see that language change turned Old English into Modern English. But Old English and Middle English are so far from us in time, it might be a temptation to think that perhaps language change is something other, something antique, something that doesn't really apply to anything that we really know well. One way to see what a living reality language change is to look at changes that have happened in English more recently, to see that it's really language as we know it and not quaint languages written with quill pens on paper that we don't see, and not something that happens off in little villages in China even, but that this is really us. And so an example would be good old semantic change. And we've seen that silly started out as blessed and then came to mean foolish. But really, you can see changes like this, as I hinted at before, even as recently, if you will, as Shakespeare. We don't process Shakespeare as readily as we often suppose. With all humility, I think there is a kind of a mythology, a bit of a hoax surrounding our reception of Shakespeare as educated people. And I will openly admit that except when I have read a Shakespeare play, and this is particularly the tragedies, when I go and hear it cold at normal speed, I don't understand enough to make the evening worth it. I don't like to admit it. I learned long ago that you're not supposed to say so, but it's true. And even as somebody who loves languages and is pretty familiar with English and all of its historical layers, I have seen The Tempest not once, not twice, but three times. Never having gotten down to reading that particular play, I have never known what in the world was going on in that play. And I seriously doubt if I'm alone. And it's not because the language is poetry. Poetry's fine. It's that Shakespeare was in many ways not writing in the language that I am familiar with. And imagine when you go sit through some Shakespeare, look at the audience at the intermission, and you look at the bright adolescent who's got almost tears in their eyes. You look at the elderly couple who are clutching each other's hands very carefully and wondering whether or not they should go home. You don't see joy in that lobby. And that's because Shakespeare's language is very hard to understand. Interesting. Shakespeare is translated into various foreign languages. And because Shakespeare is not translated into earlier varieties of the language, it means that in foreign countries, people can actually understand Shakespeare without cupping their ears, without fortifying themselves with coffee. There's none of that pretense that you had a good time. So, for example, one friend of mine said that the only time he had gone to Shakespeare and really genuinely understood it, the way we understand a play by O'Neill or by Tony Kushner, is when he saw Hamlet in France, because it was in French, it was in a relatively modern French, and he was very good at French. So, the point of all that is to say that Shakespearean language is very different from ours, and it's not because there was something peculiar about him or that we're somehow undereducated. It's because it's been many, many centuries, and the language has changed, in particular in terms of semantic drift. One of my favorite examples of this is Juliet. In Romeo and Juliet, and she says, "Wherefore art thou Romeo?" And we're often led to suppose that what she's doing is looking for Romeo. "Wherefore art thou Romeo?" And she's up on that balcony, and so apparently she's searching through the forest for him. But the thing is, why would she be looking for him? He's right there. Like right after she says, "Wherefore art thou?" she says, "Deny thy father and refuse thy name, or if thou wilt not, be but sworn my love, and I'll no longer be a Capulet." Does she really shout that off into the weeds? He's right there. "Wherefore" meant why at the time. And so it's, why are you Romeo? And the idea is, why can't you be somebody else? So deny thy father and refuse thy name, and et cetera, et cetera, and I'll no longer be a Capulet if you're no longer a Romeo. It's a very common mistake. The Tin Man in the Wizard of Oz movie, there's a little scene in the middle of his rendition of If I Only Had a Heart, and it's, "Picture me a balcony, above a voice says low." Then a female voice says, "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" And he says, "I hear a beat, boom, boom. How sweet." And so again, it's, "Wherefore art thou, Romeo?" Which implies that it's, "Where are you?" Because if the person who wrote that lyric, Yip Harburg, who was a very educated man, knew what it really meant, then he'd know that it would have to be, "Wherefore art thou Romeo? Why are you Romeo?" So there's always that mistake. Well, we can't know that unless we've had some teaching, which means that that line is completely miscomprehended. This aspect of that scene makes no sense. He's right there. But the language has changed, and so we don't know it. Twelfth Night often elicits giggles when people use the word wit. We think of wit as Katharine Hepburn and Cary Grant, as Noel Coward, as Champagne, as Frasier, etc. But wit didn't have that meaning in Shakespeare's time. So, Viola says at one point, "This fellow is wise enough to play the fool, and to do that well craves a kind of wit. He must observe their mood on whom he jests, the quality of persons, and the time." So, this fellow is wise enough to play the fool, and to do that well craves a kind of wit. Now, I've heard audiences kind of giggle there. But if you think about it, we can't underestimate Shakespeare. Now, this fellow is wise enough to play the fool, and to be a fool requires wit. What kind of insight is that? It's almost as if Shakespeare is saying, playing a fool involves being funny. Is that what makes Shakespeare so brilliant? Obviously not. And he was a modern human being just like us. He had a sense of wit, although he wouldn't have called it that, because the word wit at the time just meant knowledge. Now, we have that hovering at the edge of the language with terms like mother wit. Mother wit is not mother cracking jokes out of Restoration comedy. It's the knowledge that she has about rather humble things. Keeping your wits about you is not keeping in store a series of brittle witticisms to use at parties. It's keeping your knowledge about you. And so it's there a little bit, but wit meant knowledge at the time. And so this fellow is wise enough to play the fool, and to do that well craves a kind of knowledge. There's a certain something you have to know to be a fool. That's an interesting insight. Not, it requires being funny to be funny, which makes you quietly wonder why Shakespeare is considered so wonderful if that's the best that he can do. Or, Polonius in Hamlet at one point tells Laertes, take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. Now, that scene is a perfect one in that there are all sorts of words in that speech that have completely changed their meaning today. It's known as a famous speech, but there's so very much of it that we couldn't possibly understand without basically study. So, take each man's censure, but reserve thy judgment. So, in other words, apparently what he's saying is, take criticism from someone, but reserve your judgment. So, let people abuse you, but sit quiet. Is that interesting advice, nor does it kind of fit in with the rest of the things that he's saying. Actually, taking a person's censure meant to size someone up. So, it's size someone up, but don't talk about it. That's interesting advice, as opposed to let people shout and yell at you, but just sit there. That's not great literature somehow. And often, we're taught to assume that, well, either we don't understand, or somehow people in the past weren't quite as fine in their distinctions, or nice in their distinctions, I should say, as we are. No, it's that the language has changed. So Shakespeare is shot through with things like that, which is a great deal of why, if we haven't prepared, then much of King Lear is pretty tough, and Lord forbid anybody gets funny, because these are words that have particularly changed meanings. Humor is fragile. So often to listen to the fool in Shakespeare, goodness knows what the man is talking about. And so the actor may come on stage with auto horns and blowing soap bubbles and with long blonde hair or something like that. And so you laugh at the fool or the way he says it. But listening to what he says, there have been times when I have really wondered whether I would have gotten more out of what the Shakespearean fool was saying if it was in Vietnamese, which I do not speak. And that's because the language has changed. So semantic change makes a difference even in recent English. Grammar and pronunciation change, too. If you read Jane Austen or Middlemarch, you're getting a sense of English speakers not that far in time from us who are depicted often saying things that you think are either just, well, old or maybe slight misprints, or you don't really have time because you're trying to follow the story, but there are these little things that happen. So, for example, in Jane Austen, so, you are come at last. No, you have come, we think. What do you mean you are come? You think, is it a misprint? Is that person kind of pretentious? Well, actually, you are come is the way it would be said in many European languages, including relatives of English like German. And as it happens, English used to be one of those languages where, with certain verbs, you wouldn't use have, you would use is or are. And so, he is arrived in French, he is come in English. That continued well into the 19th century in English, and none of us today are old enough to remember it, but in that time, you could be an ordinary person and say, so, you are come at last, and it wasn't meant to sound an archaic note. This was actually the way people spoke. Jane Austen has people saying, and much was ate, and these are people who are not lower class. Eaten was not precisely necessary in all dialects of English at that time. It would be completely improper today. It would quite shock you, would not it? She has people saying. We would have, would it not? But that order was not required back then. Would not it? And you could see people saying that, chewing potatoes and whatever they were doing casually. That was ordinary English. She was small of her age at one point, Jane Austen says of someone. Again, her English was kind of different from ours. And so Jane Austen didn't know plastic. She didn't know what germs were. She didn't know recorded sound. And she said, "You are come at last." That was another way that she would have been different from us. So grammar changes in very subtle ways. We could converse with Jane Austen, but a rude little child would eventually say, "Mommy, she talks funny. You know, be quiet." But there would be these little things that she said that would kind of throw us. Pronunciation was different as well. And we get this through small clues. For example, there was a certain rather pedantic William Cobbett, and he wrote a grammar of the English language in a series of letters. This was to his 14-year-old son. And the idea here was to advise his son in how to use the language properly, this including the proper choice of forms of words. Now, we can't hear him, and so we just have to go by his book. But it's interesting that his sense of pronunciation and grammar is in many cases different from ours. So, for example, he advises "I bended." So I bended the book. To us, that's comedy. It sounds like something a foreigner would say, but to him, that was still okay. "I bent the book" was an option. He thought "I bended" was better. And clearly, he wasn't making this up himself. This was based on his sense of what he heard around him and how these things correlated with class. Very different from us, and this is in the early 1800s. Other things that he had were, "I sunk." "I sunk down to the bottom." For us, it's quote-unquote an error. For him, that was proper English. For him, a carriage was loaden, not loaded. A person got shotten, not shot. And there was also spitten instead of spit. And for him, this is somebody, probably with a periwig on, considering himself to know a certain something, explaining to his son how to come off well in general society. "I was shotten yesterday." So things change. And in the 1800s, up towards the end of them, it was typical among a cultivated set to say, "There's a house building in Mott Street," rather than "A house is being built in Mott Street." Believe it or not, to Abraham Lincoln, to say "a house is being built in Mott Street" would have sounded a little vernacular. Being the kind of person he was, he probably said it, but probably knew that this was not parlor talk. Mary Todd Lincoln, who was kind of pretentious, probably avoided saying "a house is being built in Mott Street," and maybe at some point corrected Abe and said, "It's building in Mott Street, Abe. Don't you want to sound a little better and iron your clothes?" That was something that was typical in the 1800s. Nowadays, "a house is being built." Anybody who said "a house is building," you'd let it go by, but again, you'd kind of think, they talked funny. But this was an issue that was discussed often in grammar books in the 1800s because people really did say that houses were building. So things change even recently. Now we also see how pronunciation has changed. I think we often tend to think that the way English was spoken in America, roughly before the Jackson presidency, was in this vaguely British way. But if we look at indications of the way English was pronounced by many in America in that time, we find that not only was the pronunciation not as what we process as British, as one might think, but there are a lot of things going on that just by our standards are neither British nor American, but just bizarre. So, for example, there was a pronouncing dictionary written by one John Walker in 1774, and he recommends that dismay be pronounced dismay and dismiss be pronounced dismiss. Now, unless he was just pulling these things out of his own head, we assume that there were actually people walking around using those pronunciations. Now we occasionally hear disgusting. I get the sense that it's people who are looking at the spelling and being somewhat purist about it. But disgusting is not prevalent, and certainly dismay and dismiss are quite unheard of. Then there are other things that are just different. He recommends pronouncing cement, cement. To us, that's a little backwoods. To this guy, it was the way you were to speak in society as English became a more refined language. Balcony, for him, was balcony, I've never heard anybody say balcony except maybe somebody who learned English last week. But apparently for him, this was something that people said. So pronunciation has changed. Even if these things were variants, still they were in the air in a way that they're not now because the sounds have changed. So it's interesting to remember the fact that beyond a certain very recent point, we cannot hear people speaking casually. All we've got to represent the way they talked was what people sat down and wrote. And in particular, this is a time when, for most of it, what you sat down and wrote was something that took a lot of effort. And so you have to sit down with a piece of parchment or some sort of paper that was probably expensive, and you had to write with a feather or something that had to be refilled or a pencil that was always going blunt. It was harder to write, and it was a more formal era. And so when you wrote, you generally were constrained by a sense that you didn't write the way people talked. You wrote something that was kind of artificial. We live in a very informal age in that way. And so, as a result, we really have very little sense of how people would have pronounced something before recorded sound. And recorded sound only happens beginning in, if you want to take it to the very beginning, the late 1870s, when we have Thomas Edison reciting a little bit of Mary Had a Little Lamb in a scratchy recording. That's the first time we can hear the world at all. Until then, anybody who lived in that period didn't know of recorded sound, and we can't hear them. We will never know how George Washington sounded. He talked his whole life, and yet we will never know. And all the people who heard him are now dead, so they can't tell us. And if they did, of what kind of help would that be? It's said that Abraham Lincoln had a high, reedy voice. So did Thomas Jefferson. You wouldn't think so. People said it, but we'll never know just what that voice sounded like. So one of the values of this kind of historical linguistics is to give us insights into that kind of thing. But often it is a kind of detective story because we can't know how John Adams sounded when he talked because he never recorded it, and then he died, and last time anybody checked, he's still very, very dead. So we'll never hear him. So recorded sound starts in, I believe, 1877. Before that, we're doing kind of detective work, and that's part of what linguistics is about. The Edison recording is amazing, by the way. You can tell that he knows that he's about to turn the world upside down, or at least if you're being dramatic, you wish. It's the scratching. It's like, whoosh, he's, Mary had a little lamb. His fleece was white as snow. And he's nervous. He's not used to recording anything. Imagine if you've never recorded anything, and you're sitting there, and you're saying something into this machine. For him, that must have been quite amazing. And he was a slightly stuffy man. He didn't like change, so it must have made him particularly nervous. Mary had a little lamb. And that's the beginning. So, anyway, this gives us a perspective on language change in terms of whether it's decay or growth. And so we're often told, you know, in newspaper columns and in polite society that language is going to the dogs. And so an example might be that ever fewer speakers are distinguishing lie and lay, such as the pencil is lying on the table and then I laid the pencil upon the table. And many speakers don't distinguish between disinterested and uninterested, or imply and infer. And it's often thought that somehow there's this lack of respect, or there's this decay going on, that we're becoming less of a language. And what's often forgotten is that the changes like that are exactly how Old English became modern standard English. It's these changes which at the time looked kind of annoying, but they happen anyway, for one thing. And then people generations later are thinking of that as the proper language and complaining about the new changes. And so, for example, we used to have the words hither, thither, and whither. And so the panda bear is here, or if the panda bear is over there, you might want the panda bear to come hither, to here. So you didn't say come here, you say come hither. And then if it went over there, it would go thither. If it's sitting over there, then it's there. But if it starts here and goes there, then it goes thither. Whither are you going? That's a nice distinction to have. It's very, very sweet. And German and related languages still have it. And so you can say something like, Right now, ich bin hier. I'm right here. But then, if I tell somebody to come here, I tell them to komm her. If I tell them komm hier, it means be right here and then arrive somehow, which makes no sense. Komm her. They have that distinction. If you learn German, you have to learn that here-ness is subdivided in that way. That's true of a lot of languages. It's not true of this one anymore. Now, given that none of us were alive when hither, thither, and whither were anything but kind of jokes, I think that none of us feel that the language is impoverished. I don't wish that I could say come hither. If anything, it sounds a little silly. And I don't wish there were any other word for it. Come here. If anything, it's kind of streamlined. I'm happy to learn that in other languages. And obviously the truth is, it doesn't matter. And that's because we weren't around when certainly there was a time when the language was tipping between come here and come hither. You can certainly imagine people saying, no, Timmy, say come hither, not come here. But pretty soon, that mother was gone, and Timmy kept saying what he was saying, and Timmy's child, Joshua, just always said, come here. And that took care of that. There were no people named that at the time, and actually, in that era, prescriptivist evaluative tendencies about English were not as common. But it could happen now. That's the sort of, that's the kind of debate that we'd be having now. And so, maybe a useful distinction was lost, but we have other problems. Or, often, there'll be a loss, and then when speakers try to compensate for it, we smack them for being wrong. And so a good example of this is that you used to be only a plural word in English. You was the object form. It used to be that you had, in the plural, we, ye, and they. And then in the singular, you had I, and a word that we've all heard, thou. And then he, she, and it. Thou was a singular you. So thou come here, you one person. Ye come here, you'd be overrun with 18 people. And so there was a singular and a plural. And as a result, it would be thou lookest and ye look. So that's what ye is, hear ye. Thou lookest, ye look. I see thee. And then you was the object form, I see you, meaning two or more people. Now, for reasons that no one is quite sure of, that disappeared in English and you suddenly referred to the singular and the plural. We can't imagine it any other way. It's just this pronoun that does that. Although we notice that when we go to any other language, suddenly you've got a tu and a vous, or a du and an ihr. Whatever language you go to, chances are they're going to have separate words for you singular and you plural, but we don't. So that was a loss. So English is a little naked as that goes. Can't say it ever bothered me, but it is. But then notice that there are many people where they try to say you all, or you-uns, or yous, and it's high comedy, and we think of them often as ignorant. They should stop that. But actually, that makes the language more like the other ones, because then you've got you in the singular, and then yous in the plural. These are people who are trying to make the language normal. And instead, we just see something a little truck stop about that. You're not supposed to do that when you're at the fancy ball. So it shows that there's a lack of logic behind a lot of these things. And there are all sorts of positions that we could come to. But in general, the issues are not as cut and dry as we're often taught. And the fact is that there is the grass is always greener phenomenon, which is that we're aware of the losses for various reasons. It's easy to process them. But then on the other hand, there are things that we've gained too. And it can be harder to see that there are things that we have that other languages do not. So in Shakespeare's time, while hither and thou were on their way out of the language, there was something coming in that we have no reason to think about, but which actually gives our language a kind of shade that many languages do not. And that is the way that we use ing. And so even as late as Shakespeare's time, you might say something along the lines of, I sit in this chair right now, as opposed to, I'm sitting in this chair. We use that ing in a very peculiar way. And what I mean is this. Often, if you are learning another language or if someone's learning our language, I build a house is presented as present tense because the verb is unmarked. And so I built a house, that's past. I will build a house is future. And then I build a house is present. Because that's the way it works in a lot of European languages. But if you think about it, imagine if you are, you know, you're laying some bricks or something, and somebody walks by and says, "What are you doing, Ted?" You wouldn't say, "Oh, I build a house." That's a foreigner. That would be, "I build a house." And then you think, well, he just learned English. But we wouldn't say, "Oh, I build a house." You would say, "I'm building a house right now." There is no such sentence as "I build a house" except to mean that you build a house a lot. "I build a house" means, well, whenever I get upset, I build a house. Or, you know, after my next, you know, every time I divorce, well, I build another house. It's habitual. There's no such thing as laying bricks and yelling at someone, "I build a house." And that means that we have this use of "ing," which is very specific. We can distinguish the habitual, as linguists call it, from this present progressive. In many languages, there's not much of a difference. And so you really would, in French, say, "I build a house." That'd be fine. To say, "I am in the state of building a house," would be very forced. You might say that if somebody said, "Could you please come here and fill out these income tax forms? Do you realize that I am building a house now?" But that's very explicit. But in terms of somebody walking by and saying, "What are you doing, Guillaume?" It's just, "I build a house." We have "I'm building a house" separate from "I build a house whenever I'm upset." That is something that developed in English that did not in the other Germanic languages. It's something that foreigners often have a hard time with in our language. Germans who get very good at English, the very last thing for them is mastering that "ing" and how to stretch it across the habitual and the present progressive. That's a typical Germanic learner's overgeneralization. And so English has developed some things that other languages have not. But because that to us is so very ordinary, we don't process it as one of the nicer things in our kit. And so we just tend to notice the things that we don't have that other languages have, or we notice the things that tend to be dropping away rather than the things that are coming in. But the upshot of all of this is that language is a changeable thing. Now, none of the things that we've seen of the depth of what happened from, say, Old English even to early modern English, as we've been talking about, happened from early modern English into our time. And that's because the existence of writing tends to hold these things back. But it can't do that completely. Even if people have this idealization of language in their heads and they're smacked on the back of the hand for departing from it, still, in the cracks, under the radar, the language tends to move along in certain ways that make it so that 500 years later, even if we can manage conversation, so to speak, with these people, even if we can read what they wrote, it's still very different, and not just that in the fact that they have shams and neurasthenia and other sorts of objects and concepts that have been discarded. It's also in the very way that they put the language together. So, now that we've looked at that, we're going to take a closer look at the Indo-European language family, which I have mentioned tantalizingly, I hope, in so many of these previous lectures. We're going to learn what I mean by Proto-Indo-European, which is itself a microcosmic demonstration of a worldwide phenomenon of the development of language families.
Lecture 8, Language Families, Indo-European.
This lecture is going to be about the Indo-European language family, and that's one of many language families in the world, but it's the family that English belongs to as well as many of the languages that we are most likely to learn. And Indo-European was discovered, in a way, in 1786, in a lecture that is often thought of as the beginning of modern linguistics in many ways. Sir William Jones was a jurist and an Orientalist, and he gave a lecture or address in India to the Bengal Asiatic Society, And he observed some things about ancient languages and how much they seem to have in common, which was a new observation to be making formally and in public at the time. And the quote is often cited. He said, most particularly, "The Sanskrit language, whatever be its antiquity, is of a wonderful structure, more perfect than the Greek, more copious than the Latin, and more exquisitely refined than either, yet bearing to both of them a stronger affinity, both in the roots of verbs and in the forms of grammar, than could possibly have been produced by accident. So strong, indeed, that no philologer could examine them all three without believing them to have sprung from some common source, which perhaps no longer exists." So he was noticing that Sanskrit and ancient Greek and Latin and languages of that kind seemed to be too similar for it to be accidental, and that this must mean, by simple logic, that they had sprung from something that was ancestral to all of them, and that this probably did not exist anymore. So he was inaugurating the study of what we could call the natural history of language. And the affinity that he referred to was not only in the roots in common, but also in the grammar of these languages. And you know that languages are related, particularly when they seem to have their grammars work the same way, in addition to having words that are of similar shapes. So, for example, Latin is a language where, in a way, the nouns are conjugated. There are declensions. There are these endings, just like the hablo, hablas, habla endings in Spanish, that situate the noun in terms of what kind of contribution it makes in the sentence. So, for example, the word for tooth in Latin was dens. But if you wanted to say of the tooth, like, say, the color of the tooth, then you'd say dentis. And so the color dentis, the color of the tooth. Then, if you wanted to talk about something happening to the tooth or going to the tooth, then it was denti, and so dens denti. Then, if the tooth was an object, it had to be marked with one of these endings. And so if you chipped a tooth, then you chipped not dens, but you chipped dentem. So for your nominative, your genitive, that's your of, your dative, that is to, and your accusative when it's an object, it was dens, dentis, denti, dentem. Now, what's interesting is that in Sanskrit, which is a language of India, far away from ancient Rome, while in Latin it's dens, dentis, denti, dentem, in Sanskrit it was dan, datas, date, dantam. Not the same thing, but not only are the roots similar, so Latin dens and Sanskrit dan, but then even these declensions are similar. So Latin's accusative tooth is dentem. Sanskrit's accusative tooth, its object tooth, is dantam. There's a relationship. And then in Greek, you have odon. Well, the O is at the beginning. You can think of that as kind of a throat clearing. What's interesting is the don. So dens, dan, odon. So there's a relationship. And then dens dentis, odon, odontos. And so in Greek, these four are odon, odontos, odonti, odonta. So there's a relationship here also in these endings. And of course, the endings in themselves are kind of random. There's nothing object-like about m or tem, so dens dentem. That's just an accident. So if all of these accidents seem to be parallel, then you suggest that there is some kind of source. So he, Jones, was talking about languages that are no longer spoken. But Sanskrit is the ancestor of many of the languages now spoken in India, like Hindi and Bengali and Gujarati. And ancient Greek is the ancestor of modern Greek. It has not had many children, but it still exists as modern Greek. Latin, as we've seen, is the ancestor of the Romance languages. And linguists have since found that this affinity that Jones referred to actually extended to a great many other languages, but to most of the languages of Europe, as well as Iran and India. And that's called the Indo-European language family. Indo-European is most of the languages of Europe, the exceptions being Basque, which is an isolated language that straddles France and Spain, and then also languages that are called Uralic, which includes Estonian and Finnish, and here we have Hungarian. And so it spreads over Europe, and then Indo-European also, after crossing the Fertile Crescent, is in Iran. So Persian is an Indo-European language. Persian has many relatives. They are all Indo-European. And then here in India, especially in about the upper two-thirds, languages like Hindi and Bengali and Gujarati and Rajasthani and Marathi, all of those are Indo-European. So that means that languages spoken as far west as Celtic languages like Irish Gaelic are, as the world's languages go, close relatives to languages like Marathi and Hindi in India, which of course geographically, historically, and culturally is a very different place. So that's the Indo-European language family. And you can see that they're a family by looking at the words that they have in common. So for example, we've seen a little bit of tooth. Tooth in Italian is dente. Now remember that there's a relationship between T and D. So D is often something that happens to a T, or sometimes it can be vice versa. But those are related sounds, even though they're letters separate in the alphabet. And so really what you see is tooth, and th has a certain relationship with t, and Italian has dente. So these things look like there's a relationship. French, it's pronounced dent today, but it's spelled D-E-N-T, which shows that earlier it was more like dente. Then you have Swedish, where the word for tooth is tand. And so once again, there's this T-D relationship, often with an N in the middle. And then in German, it's zahn, and the z is, again, a sound rather like T. And there isn't really as long a way as you might think between dente and zahn. Those are words that actually come from the same ancestor. Welsh has dant. In Persian, the word is dandan. Why it's repeated, there are many explanations, but the dan is what's important. Hindi, it's dant. And so all of these languages tend to have these what's called cognate words for the same concepts, which show that originally there must have been one language. Now, as far as where that language was, there is considerable disagreement. As I do these recordings, there seems to be a new flap about the subject as we're learning more and more about the genes of extinct peoples and learning how people spread across the world. But important to remember, Indo-European, the first Indo-European, was not the first language in the world, nor was it even close. We're just kind of taking the clock back, but Indo-European presumably started out as the language of one group of people, and the world was already well populated by human beings, presumably speaking at least hundreds, maybe thousands of languages at that time. Indo-European was just one that got kind of lucky in spreading across the world to be so prominent in our time. But most evidence has generally been thought to suggest that Indo-European goes back to about 6,000 years ago, 4,000 BC, on the steppes of what is now southern Russia. Most people would say that Indo-European was spoken by a group of people who are called the Kurgans, because Kurgan is the name of the burial mounds that they left behind. And it seems that this was a people who spread westward at some point into Europe and eastward at some point into Iran and India, but they would have arisen in the southern Russian steppes. Now, Indo-European or Proto-Indo-European was not written down. We presume this was not a literate culture, and so we can make guesses as to what their language was like. And in some ways, we can make those guesses based on what is not or what is in common between all the languages that are descended from it now. So, for example, there are no common words throughout the Indo-European languages for palm tree or vine, based on the fact that the words for that in the languages tend to be very different and don't seem to all trace back to one thing, suggests that the original language did not emerge where there were palm trees and vines. And so, if people encountered those things, they borrowed those words from other people, but the original people apparently were not, say, on the Mediterranean. It was not a kind of a good diet and sunny weather and brown-skinned, good-looking people and all that. It was not that. So, they were somewhere else. There is also no common word for oak. And there are certain other words that are not in common, which suggests that these people did not emerge in Europe. So despite that massive concentration of European, Indo-European languages now, one suspects that it wasn't there either. On the other hand, there are a lot of common words for horse and wheel and concepts related to things like that, which suggests that these people had horses and that they were using them as draft animals. And what's interesting is that there's evidence that the Kurgan people did have domesticated horses. So that again suggests that something was going on in these southern steppes among these people. Now, there is a theory, and it's a prominent one, that the Indo-Europeans didn't originate in southern Europe, but that they originated in what is now Turkey, and that it would have been as many as thousands of years earlier than 4000 BC. And that's getting around. You read about it sometimes in the popular science magazines. The truth is, though, that genetic evidence seems to have repeatedly pinned Indo-European speakers to the southern steppes of Russia, according to knowledge known to me right now. It seems to just not square with the Turkey theory. So there's a kind of a duking it out about that right now, and I'm not sure where it's going to come down. But I think my responsibility for these purposes is to give the southern Russian steppes, because that seems to be more likely by my reading at this point. But it could change, and there's a lot of interest in this subject, and so we'll see as time goes by. The Indo-European languages have a lot in common, but the way they've diverged shows a lot about what can happen to languages over time, and this time could be as little as 6,000 years, especially without writing, when people aren't thinking that the language shouldn't change as much as we often tend to. The language just moves on. So, for example, one of the groups of Indo-European, today there are 9 living branches, but one of the groups is Germanic. And Germanic, it's interesting. It might surprise you, but one of the languages in Germanic is German. And then there are some others, like Dutch and Swedish, Norwegian, and Danish, which are all the same language, but don't tell its speakers that. Then there's Icelandic, and there's us, English, and then there's some lesser-known ones like Frisian and Faroese. But it's a rather compact family. Depending on how you count, Germanic has 11 to 15 or 16 languages in it. And it's interesting, there's a strange sound change from Proto-Indo-European to Germanic that took place. And it's called Grimm's Law, and it's named after the same Jacob Grimm who helped collect the folk tales. He had a sideline, which was discovering things like this. And what happened with Grimm's Law is that where Proto-Indo-European had certain consonants, for some unknown reason, in clearly the ancestor to all the Germanic languages, there was this shift in the consonants. And so, for example, if Proto-Indo-European had a P, such that the word for father in a normal Indo-European language like Latin was pater, then in a Germanic language, it always came out as an F. And so that's why we don't have pater, we have father, and why German has Vater. So really, it should be pater in a way. In Sanskrit, it's pitar. And so that's what a father is supposed to look like in an Indo-European language. We've got an F. It's almost comical if you think about it. If the right sound was P, who was saying F? But apparently somebody in Proto-Germania was doing that. And so you have Grimm's Law doing that. If Proto-Indo-European had a T, and so that something came out as, say, tenuous in Latin, then for us, it's a TH, a th sound. And so tenuous, but for us, the case is not tenuous, it's thin. Or you have something that's tricolor. That's one of these Latinate words, the tri. But for us, it's three. It's not tree, it's three, that TH that came out. If Proto-Indo-European had a D, so that the word for 10 in Latin comes out as decem, and then we borrow from it and have things like decimal, then our word for it is going to be 10, because it went to T. The rules were complicated. There are exceptions, and there are other layers of it, which I won't burden you with. But there was Grimm's Law, accompanied by a couple of other processes, which meant that Germanic is really funny-sounding compared to other Indo-European languages. And there's some other things about Germanic that we'll learn. English is a very, very, very strange language in many ways. And in some ways, were handicapped by being English speakers and thinking of that as the default language, because so many peculiar things have happened to this marvelous tongue of ours. But one of them was Grimm's Law, which really kind of distorted the sound system. And so, new sounds, new languages. One of the reasons that Germanic is new languages is because of the bizarreness of Grimm's Law. That's one thing that happened. Then there are the Celtic languages. Celtic languages are now few and under threat. There is Irish Gaelic and there is Scotch Gaelic, which are basically different languages. And then there's Welsh, that is a Celtic language. There is Breton, which is spoken over across the Channel in France. And then there have been some, like Cornish and Manx, which have died and or have rather tenuous revival movements. The Manx revivalists are going to kill me for saying that, but it's tenuous. And the Celtic languages are threatened. They used to be spoken, actually, in much of Europe, and even as far as Turkey. It was a dominant group, but now they've basically been kind of shoved over into the British Isles and that part of France. And they are mostly unlikely to live as everyday spoken languages for more than another few generations. I think that's safe to say, unless language preservation efforts have some sort of unparalleled detour in success, and I don't think that's very likely. But they are very interesting languages. They're verb first, for one thing, as I mentioned, and they're famous for something called their mutations. There's a very peculiar aspect, and I say peculiar not in an evaluative way, but just in terms of how languages of the world work. This doesn't happen in just any old language, and that is that in order to speak these languages properly, you often have to switch the consonant at the beginning of the word for no particular reason, and sometimes switching the consonant conveys the entire meaning. So, for example, cat is kath. Okay, good. Now, there's a word for his and her. It's one of the many languages that doesn't distinguish gender. Lots of languages don't. It's just one choice that the cat might take is to distinguish his and her. But in this language, both his and her are a. But if you say his cat, you don't say a cath. You say a goth. And so you have to change the C to a G, and C as it's written to a G. And to just say a cath is like somebody here saying boy the instead of the boy. You don't say that. It's not good Welsh. So you have to say a goth. If you say her cat, it's a chath. So it's not a cath, it's not a goth, it's a chath. So, one cat alone, meow, is just cath. But if it's his cat, it's a goth. And if it's her cat, it's a chath. So that's different meowing. That's the way these languages work. Imagine reviving one. Imagine somebody having to master that. And of course, that's only that one little instance. These changes are different for different words. It happens after different kinds of words in the language. And so it's quite tasty, but it's quite difficult to acquire. That is one of the hallmarks of the Celtic languages. So there was Proto-Indo-European. There was no mutation in that language of that kind. Then you get one branch like Germanic where it's literally almost as if somebody with a speech defect passed on the way they spoke to a whole world of people. And that's Grimm's Law. That's not the way it happened, but it almost seems like it. Then in Celtic, you get these mutations that bedevil anybody who has to learn the language after about the age of two. And that's an exaggeration. And then there are other interesting cases. Some Indo-European languages are very conservative. Like they want to hold on to their things. I have some things in my closet that I hold on to from childhood that are not of value. So it's not that I hold it and there's a music box on the soundtrack and I hug it and I caress it and I think about something that happened when I used it, whatever it is. I've got things that didn't matter to me at all. The calendar that was hanging on my wall when I was 10 that I never liked, but I happened to keep it. I'm going to keep it. You know, little things like that. There are some Indo-European languages that are like that. They hold on to as much of Proto-Indo-European as they can. There are other Indo-European languages that seem like they want to get on with it. They want to have love beads. They want to pierce themselves. They want to kind of move on into another time. They burn CDs. And those are the ones where you really have almost alarmingly little of Proto-Indo-European left. So the conservative ones are in particular the Baltic languages. Baltic is one of these families, and Baltic only has two members now. There's Lithuanian and there is Latvian, and they are closely related. And you talk about these declensions, these cases. In Lithuanian, you've got tooth, you've got of the tooth, and that's an ending. Then you've got to the tooth, and there's an ending. Then, of course, you have to have a different ending if it's something that you do to the tooth, if the tooth is the object. Then it goes on. If something is on the tooth or beside the tooth, well, then that's a different form. If you bite something with the tooth, or if you take the tooth out and make little notches, like with, if you do something with the tooth, then that's a whole different ending. And then they even have a, what's called a vocative ending. And vocatives are kind of silly with objects, because what the vocative is if you call something. And so you don't ever have a reason to say, oh, tooth, but there is an ending for it. But a vocative makes sense with people. Like a friend of mine's name is Aglika. She is Bulgarian. When her father, who is Bulgarian, calls her, he says, Aglice. And Aglice is not her nickname. It's that when you call somebody in a language that has a vocative, you use a different form. So her nickname, I imagine, is Bulgarian for squirrel or something like that. But when you call her, Aglice, come here. Well, in the same way, technically you could say, oh, tooth, and that would be a different ending. All of that traces back to Proto-Indo-European. Lithuanian has all that mess and tone. It's an amazingly complex language. Then there's Spanish. Now, a lot of us have probably learned Spanish, but we had our problems. But Spanish is very advanced, really. And so tooth, diente. Then if it's of the tooth, there's no genitive form. It's del diente. If you're going to, for some reason, approach the tooth, then it's al diente. If you do something to the tooth, it's just diente. There's no ending. If it's on the tooth, it's sobre el diente. If you do something with the tooth, it's con el diente. There's no dientiem, dientit, none of that. It always stays the same. If you're going to call the tooth in Spanish, I guess it would be ay diente. But there's no ending for the vocative. And so Spanish has moved along, as have the Romance languages, as has English. Some of the Proto-Indo-European languages almost seem ashamed of their ancestry, whereas some of them hold on to it almost too much. And so we are speaking a rather unfaithful, kind of hasty Indo-European language, but other peoples are closer. The Slavic languages, like Russian, are almost as close as the Baltic languages too, but they're quite different in that way from, say, a French. Then, just like you have the conservatives and the ones that move ahead, some of the languages are just black sheep. They're just so different from the others that they seem to almost be turning in a sullen way away from their family. You can pierce yourself and burn CDs and still love your family very much, but two of them seem to almost not like the rest. That is Albanian and Armenian. I'll leave it as kind of like a fun little quiz for you to guess where Albanian is spoken. And Armenia is spoken in between the Black and the Caspian Seas. These are languages which are Indo-European, but it took a while for it to even be noticed. It wasn't until 1854 that it was actually even noticed that Albanian was an Indo-European language. And for a long time, people thought that Armenian was a kind of Persian. And it's because these languages have taken a whole lot of words from other language groups. So in Albanian, 1 in 12 words are actually from Proto-Indo-European. All the rest are borrowed. In Armenian, it's only 1 in 4. And so to the initial observer, if you're thinking that it's going to be like what Sir William Jones saw with the Sanskrit and the Greek and the Latin, if you're looking for that kind of parallel, Albanian is not going to give it to you. And so, for example, you look at something like the word for six. And in English, the word for six is six. And in French, it's si, but it's still spelled with an X on the end, which gives you a clue as to the way it used to be said. And si sounds kind of like six. Then in Spanish, seis. So six, si, seis. And then in German, it's sechs. Okay, that's fine. In Greek, it's hex. Okay, what's that H doing there? But still, the relationship is clear. In Albanian, it's gjashte. That has nothing to do with it. And so actually it does trace, but still that's really rather peculiar. And in Armenian, you have similar cases. And so, for example, English, two. Then French, de, T and D, but there's a relationship. Then in Greek, duo, okay. In German, zwei. But if you can get over what a Z looks like, z and t